Hello everyone, and welcome back to another enlightening episode of the History of Scotland podcast. My name is Fraser, and it's a pleasure to be your guide as we journey through the rich and complex history of Scotland. Last time, we unfolded the pages of history to reveal the profound ecclesiastical shifts during the reign of David I, the king who sought to bring the Scottish Church in line with the overarching European model. We delved into the minute of the Davidonian Revolution and explored how the monarch sculptured the religious landscape of Scotland to mirror the advancements and ideological shifts happening on the continent. Today, however, we steer our historical ship into the vibrant waters of nobility, immersing ourselves into the lives, influences, and narratives of the various Scottish noble families during the epoch of David I. The chapter of Scotland's past is embellished with the tales of power, allegiance, rivalry, and the intricate web of relationships that bound the nobles to the throne, and also to each other. As we traverse through the domains of the Flemish, Gaelic, Norse, and Anglo-Norman families, we will glimpse into their worlds, unravelling the threads of their stories amidst the dynamic and at times tumultuous reign of David. David's realm was a mosaic of cultures as we know, whether they were Gaelic, Norman, Anglo-Saxon, or Norse. These influences blended and at times clashed. The families that rose to prominence during his reign were not just mere spectators but active participants, shaping and being shaped by the era's pulsating political and social currents. Some of these noble families and houses are renowned, their names echoing through the corridors of history, while others linger in the more subtle traces, their tales nevertheless significant in crafting the narrative of Scotland during the 1100s. So as we delve deeper, let us linger in the 1100s a bit more, a time where the bonds of fealty intertwined with the ambition and kingship, shaping the destinies of families and in turn the trajectory of Scotland itself. Some of these families you've obviously heard of, such as the Balliols and the de Bruce family. But what about the Lambertons or the Macheffs? Well, we're going to delve into their stories regardless and give you a good understanding of the families and noble, you know, characters during David's reign. People who were in his court, the people that helped him lead Scotland during the Davidonian Revolution. So listeners, are you ready to embark on this journey? This is going to be a long episode, so strap yourself in, get some food or drink, turn up the speakers in the car if you're listening whilst you travel, or turn your headphones up whilst you're walking. Let's cast our minds back, way back to the 1100s, picture the castles and the vibrant lands, the hills and mountains of Scotland, hear the clashing of swords at the Battle of the Standard and the oath sworn in the candlelit halls, and let's explore together the lives and tales of the nobles in the era of David I. Let us wander into the domains of two Flemish families that cast their fates with the Scottish crown, embarking upon a path that would weave their destinies intricately with the era of David I, the de Lambertons and the de Lisles. Detailed historical record of the de Lambertons family, particularly during the reign of David I, is not overly abundant, especially in terms of specific individuals and their exploits during the precise period. Records become more apparent and detailed in later centuries, particularly in relation to figures such as William de Lambton, Bishop of St Andrews during the late 13th and early 14th centuries. But if we do delve into the reign of David, political changes and also social changes he was ushering in also helped bring in new families from the continent. These were Norman and French culture influences, particularly within the Scottish aristocracy and church. Yet specific mention of the de Lambertons family during David's reign is not prolific in the surviving historical documents. So let's consider the historical landscape. The family could have begun establishing their influence during David's reign, embedding themselves in the ecclesiastical and administrative mechanisms that David sought to develop and reform. If we infer from the status and activities of the other similar noble families of the time, it's plausible that the Lambertons were engaged in common noble activities, such as the land management, military service, such as a battle at Standard, and possibly involvement in local justice and administration. Given the later notable ecclesiastical role of William de Lambertons, Britain, it's plausible that family members during David's reign were developing strong ties with the church, perhaps benefiting from David's extensive patronage of the religious establishments. Forming and sustaining a strategic alliance through marriages or supporting the king, potentially opposing the factions as well, in various political and military ventures was also very pivotal during this period. As I said, the exact details are very scarce, so the de Lambton families, we can't really pick up what they were doing during David's reign, but we can infer the strong narrative of gradual establishment through alliance building and getting themselves close to the Church of Scotland through the ecclesiastical and administrative reforms that David was bringing in. They were most likely supporters of his reforms and thus benefited from this support. The de Lisle family was of Norman descent and were entirely different. They were also established in Scotland during the reign of David and came to have significant influence in later periods of Scottish history. Bartolov was a Hungarian nobleman and is considered the primogeniture of the Leslie family in Scotland. He was reportedly in the service of Princess Margaret when she journeyed to Scotland to marry King Malcolm III. Yes, Saint Margaret of Scotland. And this was obviously around the 11th century. Bartolov's descendants adopted the name de Lisle after being granted lands in Lisle, which, if you know your locations and geographies of Scotland, is located in Aberdeen. Under David I, the de Lisles, like many other noble families from abroad, might have been granted lands in return for their military and administrative service. Bartolov's descendants, including his son Malcolm, were likely involved in managing and administrative these lands, possibly playing roles in the local justice and governance, but also spreading the reforms of the Davidonian Revolution. The de Lisles, owing to their noble status, would have been expected to provide military service, either directly by serving in the king's campaigns or providing men-at-arms. Engagements like the Battle of the Standard in 1138 against English forces were defining moments in David's reign, which we did cover in his early episodes, so please go listen to them, and the de Lisles might have played a role in such campaigns. The de Lisles would have likely have sought to consolidate their position through strategic marriage alliances with other noble families similar to the de Lambtons, both of Scottish and foreign origin. Managing their estates in Aberdeen, they ensured the productivity of the agricultural lands and oversaw any local industries or commerce that was ongoing during their towns. This might have involved dealings with local free tenants, overseeing serfs and managing resources and revenues. In line with the prevalent culture of the era, the de Lisles might have engaged in religious patronage as well, potentially founding or endowing religious establishments along with the Davidonian revolutions of the church reforms. This was common practice for nobles seeking to secure spiritual benefits and establish a lasting legacy. The de Lisles, given their foreign origins, are likely the status as new settlers, meaning they were aliens. They might have been particularly eager to align themselves closely with David and his successors, ensuring their continued favour and safeguarding their recently acquired lands and titles. The complex web of alliances and familial ties and feudal obligations would have required an adept political navigation. In the generations following David I's reign, the de Lisles continued to be prominent figures in Scottish history, becoming one of the country's most powerful families. They established strong connections with other influential families, further integrating into the Scottish nobility, and were involved in various capacities in the subsequent political, military, and ecclesiastical developments. While specific details about the de Lisles during David's reign might be sparse, understanding their likely roles and activities provides a window into the lived experiences of the noble classes during this transformative period in Scottish history. But let's move on to the Gaelic, Norse and Celtic families. These are people we have already heard of. These are the natives of Scotland, the people we've been following since the Picts and since the Kingdom of Alba. And during David's migration of the external alien families to the kingdom, they were certainly up in arms about the aliens, and I'm using quotation marks here, aliens arriving into Scotland. No, not green, scary creatures from space. No, I'm talking about foreign families coming into prominence, taking over their roles in the royal court. Now, we have already told the story of Donald MacHeth and his rebellion against David in episode 34, A New King. But as a quick recap, we know Donald MacHeth was often regarded as the leader of the uprising against the Scottish monarch. Twice, in fact. Obviously, in 1130, in conjunction with Angus of Moray, he engaged in a rebellion against David. He then was suppressed, his revolt was quashed, and he was then made a captive. His captivity is documented in the later years of David's reign and extended into the reign of David's successor, Malcolm IV. Donald's fate reflects the broader strategy employed by David in dealing with regional resistance, seeking to subdue and control dissident factions through military and political means. Despite Donald's capture, elements of resistance continued. The MacHeths, along with other disaffected kindreds, remained a source of periodic unrest in the Scottish Highlands and the North, especially around Moray as we know. These tensions, often framed as a being between the Gaelic-speaking regions and the Anglicised Norman South, encapsulated a period of transition and contention during David's attempts to integrate these regions into his domain. MacHeths and other Highland families found themselves in a period of tension and transition, being symbols of regional resistance against the centralising efforts of the Scottish monarchy. Their lives, especially those in the leadership positions like Donald, were marked by periodic rebellion, negotiation, and confrontation with the forces of the Scottish king. For the MacHeths, navigating the political landscape was hard. Donald may have failed, and the rest of his family continued to decline through the later years of the Scottish kings. This also saw the lands of Moray come into power of the Kingdom of Scotland, so people like the MacHeths actually made things worse for themselves. They lost power, the Celtic families lost power due to the new Norman families and David's power that he held at the throne, his centralising nature, his modern army. He was able to crush resistance very easily. Now, a separate family that we haven't spoke about were the MacNinnans, or Clan Fingon. They were a small family whose early history is somewhat shrouded in mystery, but during the reign of David I, the family's specific roles and actions are not as thoroughly documented as those of the larger, more politically involved families of, say, the MacHeths and Donald. It's challenging to pinpoint the specific leading members of the MacNinnans during David's reign due to the scarcity of the records. General historical understanding, however, posits that the MacNinnans were established in the areas such as Skye and Mull, regions that were somewhat in the background of the central political drama at the time. Given their geographical location and the broader political context, it's likely that the MacNinnans, like many of the families of the Highlands and Islands, were engaged in local power dynamics, perhaps involving alliances with the opposition to the neighbouring Norman families or kindreds such as Donald. The Highlands and the Islands during the 12th centuries were characterised by a mosaic of local lordships and power bases. These are bases that David wanted to destroy and make more centralised. Families like the MacNinnans would have been engaged in a complex web of allegiances, trying to keep their family's power maintained, but in the context of David's reign, it's conceivable that the MacNinnans, like other Highland families, were observers of, occasionally participants in, the broader shifts of occurring in the Scottish lowlands and central belt. David's reforms and ecclesiastical changes, along with his fostering of Norman-style lordships, could have, well, made them dislike the king. And especially in the Highlands, influenced the ways in which the families like the MacNinnans navigated their local and regional politics. While specific military actions during David's reign are not clearly recorded with the MacNinnans, plausible to consider that given the persuasive tensions and conflicts of the era, they might have been involved in the local skirmishes or rebellions, particularly those that involved his neighbouring families. But the MacNinnans would not fail like the MacHeths did. Given their island locations, they were given to seafaring, fishing, and perhaps piracy or seaborne raiding. Whilst there are aspects of their livelihood and social practice connecting them to wider maritime networks and possibly involving them in disputes and alliances with other seafaring kindreds. We'll try to keep up with the MacNinnans as we go throughout the history of the future descendants of David I, but families like these will lose certain power bases and their ways of life will change, but their family history and legacy will carry on and will live on through some descendants in centred power positions controlled by the Scottish throne. Now, let's move on to another family. This family is the McDulls. Now, recognising specific McDull figures during David's tenure entails us delving into an area where the historical records, as we know, are very sparse, especially regarding the clans in the Scottish Highlands and Hebrides. The McDulls, typically associated with areas like Argyll, were likely immersed in the regional politics and skirmishes similar to the other Gaelic Celtic families. However, with clear historical markers, the relationship between David and the McDulls remains nebulous. They conceivably, like many of their families, became subordinates to David's rule, and more importantly, welcomed the change. They were ensconced in the territorial debate, but they didn't dissuade the changes that David were bringing in. They, well, helped welcome it. They actually helped David spread the Davidonian Revolution in their lands. So they weren't actually contenders of rebellion. They actually welcomed the change and in turn became strong supporters of the Scottish throne. Although the specifics of the interactions and individuals during David's reign are somewhat blurred, we can piece together a plausible narrative that envisions a family of an emerging clan navigating through the labyrinth of politics of regional power, material survival, and intermittent conflict. Emanating from this are the rich, if fragment, images of a vibrant, robust, and often tempestuous life amidst the moors, mountains, and seas of 12th century Scotland. This family would go on to play a famous ally of the Kings of Scotland for many years to come, helping fight off would-be invaders of the Scottish throne and becoming strong supporters of every independent Scottish nobleman dream. And as I'm sure you're all aware, we're going to be hearing of them very soon in the coming English invasion of Scotland. So stand by, the McDulls are going to be here to stay. Now, let us touch upon the Anglo-Norman families that David gave power to and the lordships, helping his Davidonian Revolution spread throughout Scotland. These families will become giants during the next 100 years and will lead Scotland into turmoil and then back out of it again. Gone are the days of the dominant Gaelic Scoto-Norman families. In their place rose these families instead, in effect finally closing the book on the Kingdom of Alba. Some of these key figures who were more based in the English court were figures such as Robert de Beaumont, 1st Earl of Leicester, and Henry de Beaumont, 1st Earl of Warwick. These brothers, son of Roger de Beaumont and Edlin of Moulin, played critical roles in English politics and had significant influence during David's reign during the border conflicts, considering obviously the interwoven political scenarios as we've already transpired between Scotland and England during David's reign. But we're here to learn about the Scoto-Norman families, so let's turn to the FitzAlans. The threads of their story originate with Alan FitzFlad, a Breton noble whose actions and loyalty to the English crown cast long shadows that reached the chilly landscapes of Scotland. His son, Walter FitzAlan, would burgeon into a figure of pivotal significance, empowering and embodying the essence of power dynamics and encapsulating the 12th century Scottish political arena. With David I's ascension in 1124, Scotland witnessed palpable shifts in the socio-political equilibrium. Walter FitzAlan, following his father's entrusted martial and noble trajectory, was invited to Scotland and was appointed the High Steward of Scotland by David, reflecting an astute recognition of Walter's potential to navigate the intricate lattice of Scottish politics. In a realm where the gravitational pull of power perpetually drew nobles into a tumultuous alliance and sometimes conflict, Walter's role was far from a merely administrative one. His stewardship was interwoven with duties that extended to acting as a guardian to the heirs during fragile transitional periods and undertaking military endeavours that sought to secure and stabilise the often turbulent borders of the nation. Walter FitzAlan, a seasoned military strategist, was inevitably thrust into the campaigns of David I as well. His role was not just limited to serving the king in military exploits, but also entailed protecting the interests of the crown in these border regions, particularly where the tensions between Scotland and England became very fragile, such as the Battle of the Standard. Walter was not merely a warrior though. His political savvy allowed him to manoeuvre the matrimonial alliances that enmeshed the FitzAlans with other noble lineages, fortifying their position amidst the noble echelons of other noble families. Moreover, his endowment of the lands in Renfrewshire by David I didn't just symbolise a reward, but acted as a mechanism through which Walter could perpetuate the FitzAlan legacy within Scotland. His founding of Paisley Abbey around 1163 reflected not only personal piety, but also a political manoeuvre, showcasing his family's commitment to the ecclesiastical advancements of the realm, a theme that we know David loved to do. Walter's deed, forged in the crucibles of military and political and ecclesiastical arenas, would reverberate through time. His lineage, under the evolved name of Stuart, or Stuart, yes, that name, the Kings of Stuart, would one day find themselves seated not only on the Scottish throne, but also the English one. Testament to the intricate and often unpredictable nature of noble ascendancy. Navigating through the political landscapes of David I's Scotland, Walter FitzAlan solidified a legacy that burgeoned beyond his temporal existence, weaving the FitzAlans and later the Stuarts into a vibrant historical tapestry of Scotland and England alike. And I find it mental that Walter FitzAlan became Steward of England, his family would later change his name to Stuart, and then they would become Scottish kings and then English kings and rule all of Britain. It's insane to think of this family's trajectory, but similar to the De Bruce family, small beginnings sometimes lead to grand finales. Anyway, let's touch on another kind of big family in the Anglo-Norman sphere in Scotland. The Balliol family. They emerged on the Scottish political stage, destined to navigate through the intricacies of power and allegiance. During the reign of David, the family's presence was significantly shaped by its patriarch, Bernard de Balliol, a man of Norman descendancy. He was born around the early 12th century. Bernard would have tread a path that delicately danced between ambition and loyalty, carefully laying the foundations of his family's fortune to the burgeoning political landscape of David's Scotland. Now, Bernard was not only a keen observer of the political currents, but also a skillful participant in them. With lands in England and notably in Scotland, the Balliol family became strategically intertwined with the socio-political endeavours of David's reign. David, known for his penchant for endorsing and uplifting Norman and Anglo-Norman lords, found in Bernard a steadfast and strategic ally. Bernard acquired significant estates in Scotland, primarily in the Tyvoke area, and thus begun the family's consequential association with the Scottish nobility. The bond was further solidified through strategic marriages, alliances crafted not just for kingship, but for uniting a robust network of political and military support. In the chaotic Battle of the Standard in 1138, where David suffered a defeat against the English, the Balliol family found themselves in a quagmire of allegiance. For Bernard, his lands and connections across the Scottish and English realms presented a precarious position. However, notably, Bernard stood firmly by David, a stance not only showcased by the depth of their alliance, but also shaped with the trajectory of the Balliol family's future in Scotland. Their allegiance at such a pivotal moment illustrated a staunch loyalty that would in time weave the Balliols into the intricate narrative of the Scottish throne. Unlike the De Bruce family, which we'll get onto very shortly in terms of how they betrayed David during the Battle of the Standard. The post-battle era saw Bernard's loyalty bear fruit. David, despite his defeat, continued to hold substantial influence and control over Scotland. The Balliol family, having demonstrated their unwavering support, was rewarded with further lands and privileges. Bernard's son, also named Bernard, inherited not only his father's lands, but also his political acumen and alliances. The younger Bernard's marriage to Angus, the daughter of Alan of Galloway, was another strategic union that further embedded the Balliol family into the rich and political embroidery of Scotland. The story of the Balliol family under David's reign is marked by astute political manoeuvring and loyalty. Loyalty being the king. While the Balliols under David manoeuvred with remarkable consistency, their future generations would navigate through a maze of rebellion, kingship, and resistance, forever intertwining their legacy with the storied annals of Scottish past. and we would know a certain John Balliol would try and succeed in becoming King of Scotland. But that wouldn't last, and under Edward I of England, we know where that would lead to. But let's save that for our future episodes, coming hopefully very soon to a podcast near you. Now let's shift our focus to another family, the St. Clairs. In the epoch of David I's reign, the St. Clair family, hailing from Norman roots, found themselves embarking upon the shores of opportunity within the realms of Scotland. Led by William de St. Clair, they established themselves firmly amidst the Scottish nobility, navigating through the complexities of alliance, conquest, and fealty. William de St. Clair was a distinguished noble whose life in Scotland during David's reign was intricately interwoven with the king's ambitions to remodel the Scottish church and state. William's adherence and alignment with David's vision positioned the de St. Clair's family as a formidable entity in the political landscape. His interactions with David shaped the family's fortune, providing them with not only a tangible reward in terms of lands and titles, but also positioning them within the pulsating heart of Scottish power dynamics. Throughout David's reign, the de St. Clair family were conferred with extensive lands and noteworthy titles. William, as a reliable ally to David, played an integral role in executing the king's plans of territorial governance, often acting as a stabilising force amidst the fluctuating political currents. His stronghold, Roslyn Castle, situated near Edinburgh, became synonymous with the de St. Clair family, echoing their stature and influence in Scotland across the generations. William de St. Clair would also serve in the Battle of the Standard and would become a staunch, loyal supporter of David. He didn't back down, and he held the lines as the retreating troops left the battlefield, further solidifying his favour in the royal court. William's descendants, notably his son Henry de St. Clair, would inherit not just the tangible domains, but also the legacy of the political alliance and favour with the Scottish monarchy. Henry, keeping the legacy alive, continued to intertwine the family's fortunes with the fate of Scotland, ensuring the Sinclair, which was renamed in the later years, would remain attached within the annals of Scottish nobility. So the de St. Clairs would become the Sinclair family in the future. Obviously, we'll get to the Sinclairs in the future. At the moment, they're known as the de St. Clairs. A little bit different. Finally, we have the de Bruce family, or the de Bruce, or Bruce family, however you want to know them by. I'm going to call them the Bruce family, but do be aware, similar to the de St. Clairs, they are known as the de Bruce family to begin with. The saga of the Bruce family unfurls its chapters from the tapestry of the Norman Conquest. Originating from Brie in Normandy, the family marked their initial footprint on British soil around 1066, post William the Conqueror's conquest of England. A significant member of this era was Robert de Bruce, who made a strategic marriage to Agnes, daughter of the powerful Wulfric of Earl of Northumbria, in 1103 AD, establishing a resilient pillar in the formation of a dynasty. As David I ascended the Scottish throne in 1124, his reign promised a burgeoning period for the de Bruce family. Extensive lands in Arndale, Cumbria became a testament to Robert de Bruce's loyal services and prudent alliances with David. However, the subsequent years saw an evolving dynamic, with Robert de Bruce the Elder's death in 1141 and his son also Robert inheriting the burgeoning power and responsibilities. But their fortune was intricately intertwined with the allegiance and survival. A crucial juncture materialised during the Battle of the Standard in 1138. The younger Robert faced a dire choice: uphold the legacy of his father's loyalties to David I, or safeguard his substantial estates in England by aligning with the English forces. He chose the latter and steered the family into a tempest of betrayal and political machinery. Like we told in episode 34, A New King, younger Robert rode up to David I and begged him to turn back and leave England's lands. He tried to persuade David to go to a more diplomatic solution rather than a militaristic one. David ignored him, but when Robert betrayed him, David would remember this. David remembered the betrayal of the Dupreez family. He saw the Balliols side with him even though they had English estates. But the Dupreez family, who had English estates, chose to side with England. And thus, as the battle was lost and David retreated from the lands of England, the Dupreez family was in trouble in Scotland, and David would make sure there was a price to pay for his betrayal. David's forces were vanquished in the battle, and the political narrative shifted in the ensuing years. If we jump ahead to David's death, the political landscape evolved, offering the Dupreez family opportunities to reposition themselves back favourably amidst the Scottish elite. They accomplished this through political manoeuvrings and strategic alliances, most notably through the marriages in the Celtic aristocracy, creating a web of interlinked nobility that was hard to untangle. However, the loom of destiny intricately wove through these complex dynamics, leading us towards a figure that would immortalise Robert the Bruce. He, a sixth-generation descendant of the initial Norman settler, would embody a paradox of rebellion and rightful claim, leading Scotland towards a pivotal Battle of Bannockburn in 1314 AD, a topic that promises stories of power and gallantry in our forthcoming narratives and episodes. But yes, the Dupreez family story is one of us of survival, a tale where the strategic navigation and betrayal sees them lose power in Scotland and sees them fall out of favour with the Scottish throne. But after David's death, we will see how the younger Robert and his sons will eventually gain power back in Scotland, become one of the biggest noble families in Scotland, and then, as I've said, in the 1300s, Robert the Bruce would eventually become King of Scotland. So you've got all of that to look forward to. But at this moment in time, during David's reign, they betrayed him at the Battle of the Standard. They no longer have Scottish lands, and they are stuck in the English court and English subjugation. But that will change, and we will keep up with the Dupreez family as we continue our narrative through David I's descendants. Ah, the echoes of the past, dear listeners, they never fail to enthrall, do they? The clashing of swords, the subtle whisperings of alliances forged and broken in the candlelit chambers of medieval Scotland. All these tales of yesteryears we've unfolded together today. Though the storied chronicles of the noble families during David I's reign, we've traversed the lands and centuries and caught glimpses of the strategies devised within the castle walls and witnessed the interwoven destinies of those who would shape the very essence of Scotland. My name is Fraser, and I sincerely hope that this episode transported you back to the era where the foundations of a nation were being intricately and often tumultuously laid down by the likes of the Dupreezes, the Balliols, and the Sinclairs. Their stories of ambition, political manoeuvrings, alliances, and at times treacherous paths have woven the vibrant, rich tapestry, as we always keep going on about, that is Scottish history. But alas, dear friends, that's all the time we have for today. The sands in our historical hourglass have run dry in this episode, yet the tales of the past are far from exhausted. In our next episode, we'll be treading the twilight years of David I, delving into the sunset of his reign, exploring the poignant tales of his later years, his succession, and the moment where Scotland laid one of his most transformative kings to rest. Although the mere thought brings a reluctant heaviness to our hearts, the stories from his concluding chapters are as riveting and crucial as those from his ascent. So do join us next week as we bid farewell to a king who shaped Scotland in ways that still echo through the ages. Our journey through the annals of time unfails every week, so I invite you to continue this exploration with us in our next episode, releasing just 7 days hence from today. So stay tuned and stay curious. In the interim, dear listeners, I encourage you to follow us on Twitter at TheHistoryOfSC1, that is, at TheHistoryOfSC1, and like our Facebook page, The History of Scotland Podcast, to stay abreast of updates, behind-the-scenes peeks, and engage in fascinating historical discussions. Your thoughts matter to us, so please leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Podbean. Your insights and feedback carve out the path for our journey through history, ensuring it is enlightening for you as it is for us. So, until our paths cross again in the meaningful trails of Scottish history, have a splendid week. May your days be as vibrant and enduring as the tales we share. goodbye, and may the echoes from the past always whisper fascinating stories to your present. See you later.